Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed. So I call your name.
And welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm Bob Ginsberg, your host, and I have a great guest tonight, Dr. Robert, or Bob Davis. Robert Davis is an internationally recognized research scientist and author. And after receiving his doctorate degree in 1981, he conducted research, he taught, and was an administrator for the State University of New York for over 30 years. Bob has spoken about his research on the effects of environmental and toxic stimuli on the brain and sensory systems in venues that vary from national and international scientific conferences to over 60 published research articles in scholarly journals. And since his retirement, he's spoken on over 100 national and international radio shows and podcasts, mostly about his recent research publications on the science of the subjective and human consciousness. He has three very good books that he has written, Unseen Forces, The Integration of Science, Reality, and You, Life After Death, An Analysis of the Evidence, and The UFO Phenomenon, Should I Believe? You can find a lot more about Bob and his work and his upcoming movie on the website bobdavisspeaks.com. Bob, it's been too long. It's the last time you were on the show was in 2019, so it's a great honor to have you back.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Bob. Thank you for all you do, for your kind and interested, enthusiastic audience to learn more about this enigmatic topic that you talk about, and it's very stimulating. So I'm very eager to speak with you again. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, enigmatic is a good word when it comes to this stuff. Yes, so you talk a lot about, and you've written extensively about, the peak experience, and I think our listeners probably have an idea of what a peak experience is, but how would you define it?
It's a very generalized term, initially coined by Maslow, Walter Stace, Ivan Kassan, who founded the Spiritual Awakenings Institute, who's had near-death experiences, Kundalini awakenings. I'm sure you're very familiar with her. Then termed the spiritually transformative experiences as how we should label what Maslow and Walter Stace described as that sense of unity between the inner self and the external environment and the associated positive, intense positive emotions and the alterations, as we know, of course, of time and space. But that consists of the peak experiences. It was addressed long, long ago. It's in the Bible. I'm not a reader of the Bible, but it's recognized there by scholars who read it metaphorically, but it's there all over. People have had this and they have it now. But that reality, the insights that are indescribable, ineffable, I think is a common term we use for it, and the positive after effects, and maybe more than anything, Bob, is that aspect of this phenomenon that many of these peak experiences that come in different shapes and sizes. We're talking about trigger events, whether it's a near-death experience, an out-of-body, even interaction with the non-human intelligence, as people commonly report, especially now when some of the stigmas is declining in terms of that phenomenon, the UAP phenomenon. But not only that, DMT can induce these peak experiences. These kinds of triggers create this spiritual transformative experience, and then that ontological shock, where people now realize, Bob, and you know this, that reality is different than it ever was. They question their reality, and questioning it with that fierce determination, which is sparked by the trigger, call it what you will, is that ontological shock. Why me? What happened? What is this about? Who do I talk about it to? It's a different world. I got to go to work. I got to raise the kids. You know, the scene. And throws a lot of people into a spiritual emergency, as you well know. You talk about this. Yeah. It's a whole chain of events. And you know, the medical psychiatric community is not well designed to deal with it, unfortunately.
Not at all. And also regarding peak experience and exploration, I mean, it very often, especially in the work we do, we find that trauma and loss are often triggers for this kind of exploration. And people start thinking of concepts that they never entertained before. It's interesting that you mentioned the Bible and these things. Peak experience has been around for so long, because a lot of people, unless they're students of history, don't realize that we live through ages of mysticism that lasted tens of thousands of years. And many of the founders of today's organized religions came out of those ages, where things that we're talking about as that are dismissed by science today existed then and still exist. It's just that maybe it's coming to the forefront a little bit more now.
Yeah, you know, you're exactly right. And today, because of our technological environment, we address it very differently than they did at the time when they were writing things down on cave walls and scrolls and Bibles and other texts of related folklore, etc. But it's written all over the place. These encounters with dwarfs, with elves, these entities of varying types, non-human in nature, from supreme beings that communicate with them, generally telepathically. We have that now, and you're exactly right. Even with this is kind of induced with trauma. I once, for instance, met someone at a burger. It was a Burger King about 5 years ago. He was wearing a collar. Reverend, he sat down right next to me because it was very crowded. He asked for his permission, and he saw I was reading the book Life After Death, and my name was on it, and we obviously started talking about it. Then he opened up, and he talked about the fact that he was an alcoholic, in the worst shape, on his knees praying to God for help. When suddenly he saw the image of what he interpreted as a deity. He thought it was Christ. It was a golden, glowing, human-like presence in front of him, as real as the back of his hand, the scene. And he then started a mission, just helping people around the world, spreading the word, helping them in any way possible. And we see this kind of transformation induced by some peak experience. That's the kind of form it took for him. For another, it comes for every person. It comes in a different way with a different trigger. Call it consciousness, intent, whatever you want to call it. That force, that inner force that's its mind's much smarter than I have written about and studied, without an answer. We theorize about it. It's entertaining. It's challenging, of course. But, people in grief need to try. And I've been there with pain. And we've all been there, of course, in varying ways, emotional, physical. My gosh, life is surrounded by that. I hate turning on the television, forgetting the news, let alone finding a decent movie that fits. But they receive messages, with the beauty of it. Even if when you're on your hands and knees, the beauty of it is trying to have faith in the reports by others who are have been in that position, and they do at some point have a death, an after death communication right before they're dying, or they have some inner knowingness of receiving intentions or communication of love and kindness, friendship from non-human intelligences or supreme beings, deceased relatives. And they do this through different kinds of practices, and it's and sometimes pain can do this. You know, when you try to become more spiritual, finding truth, you're meditating more, doing whatever you can to become a truth seeker. Listening to your show is just one part of it. You know, why are people drawn to the topic to begin with? Why do we discuss it? You know, it's part of human beings where we carry that behavior that our ancestors, getting back, I guess, to that question, that's transmitted genetically. You know, we probably have a gene for it because it transgenerational epigenetic inheritance, something that's studied and taken seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, even they'd say Holocaust, children of Holocaust victims have been affected by the fact that their grandparents went through such horrific conditions. And that has been duplicated with other populations under similar circumstances. So we receive those codes, and we're spiritual like they were, trying to seek truth, looking for God.
And then, you know, in that sense, these peak experiences and the transformation that goes along with it is what's really important. But that's where these direct personal experience can take us places that science, at least not yet, can take us. You know, I took the science route. You know, after my daughter passed, and because I was trying to see if there was any credible evidence from credentialed people that suggested that our consciousness, you know, could survive. But that only took me so far. I would never got to later on in life I did. But for many, many years, I was always jealous of people that were, that had these transformative experiences, you know, because all of a sudden they're flipped, you know, and they change the way they live. And all the books that I read and all the people that I interviewed, I couldn't get to the same place.
You didn't have a trigger.
No. Well, I had the trigger, but the trigger didn't, you know, the trigger being the profound loss.
No, that's not necessarily a trigger. That's not a common trigger. That, you know, we're talking about near-death experiences.
Yeah.
Psychoactive agents.
Right.
Things like that, we do see grief reactions, yes. But for some reason, it happens. Like, why do some people claim to report interacting with non-human intelligences? Some people are clinically dead for 2 minutes and they don't have an NDE. We see such variability, and that it's hard to explain. Some of it is brain-based. Some of it may be personality in nature too, susceptibility, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? But I know what you mean. We look sometimes looking for the answer or having faith-based rationale that something is going to happen, that because you want it to happen, makes it happen. But despite the studies that are done on these transpersonal after effects of these spiritual transformative experiences, let's call them STEs, that we need to have the themes, the features of each trigger in order to understand it, because they're seldomly explored. There's been some studies on that, but they focus on these selective things, not specifically what you're talking about, but we need to expand it. The range of our understanding, science doesn't get at it. They can't study consciousness. It can't be quantified. We know that. So we only qualify it anecdotally. And that's a challenge. And most people don't want to open up. And how do you get to the essence of what they're trying to say? Because we don't have the language to describe it. For them to describe it, it's ineffable. How do they describe alterations of time and space, such a beautiful scenery? You know, for the film Conscious Connection, which I'm co-producing with Dave Beatty and Wilson Hawthorne, where if I may, because it pertains to this.
Yeah,
it's called A Conscious Connection at consciousnessfilm.info. And if anybody's interested in supporting us in any way for travel, not to put in our pocket, believe me, it's sweat equity. You know, it would be wonderful. We're looking for investors in it. I'm sorry to say that and use this platform, but as a producer, unfortunately, I have to mention it. And
absolutely.
A lot of people resonate with it and want to support something like that as an investor or contribute like they would to any good cause.
And I would add that there is a trailer on your website, bobdavisspeaks.com, 3-4 minutes. I watched it and it's pretty intriguing. So people can take a look at that.
Yeah, thank you. And film website, consciousnessfilm.info. Again, tries to get at that. What is consciousness? Why do people have these kinds of transformative experiences? What is near death experience? All of that. And we've interviewed, for instance, Eben Alexander. Remarkable story of NDE. I don't want to rehash the details. I'm sure more than half of your audience has read his material.
Yeah.
But what gets me about his experience, let alone the transformative, or as you said, flip. And he's an example of someone who flipped from a neurosurgeon to now someone who talks about his near-death experience and meditation, hemisync, etc. Is that he claims to have met his deceased sister, who he never knew he had. And when he met her and got her name and other details of the family, he then gave that information to his parents after his near-death experience, when he was conscious, of course, and they were dumbfounded, couldn't believe the accuracy and detail, the details that he shared with them, because they never, according to them, never shared it with him. So those kinds of unique nuances, you got to find them to verify, to validate those kinds of bits of information that exist. But here again, science does not grab that and say, oh, you have proof. E equals MC squared. We have the answers, life right after death, you know? So, but people in grief need to look at maybe these kinds of examples.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more because, I mean, for somebody that's in grief and, you know, grieving the loss of a loved one, the only thing that gives them any kind of hope or comfort is the belief that their loved one still exists in some form. And they come to that point, you know, it's sort of like cognitive behavior therapy of, you know, changing the way they think about death. And that's why we like to talk about all these things we're talking about, NDEs and then the life experiences and reincarnation and so forth. And, you know, Bruce Grayson was once speaking at one of our conferences. And it always stayed with me because just to paraphrase his comments at the end, he said something like, listen, it's easy to dismiss any one discipline of research. You can dismiss the near-death experience and, you know, or dismiss mediumship or dismiss the reincarnation evidence and so forth. But when you step back and you look at all of the evidence as a whole, the thing that makes the most sense is that we survive our physical death. And that always stayed with me. And I think that's important, you know, because you want to listen to the skeptical arguments about, you know, one thing, but, you know, you have to be able to absorb everything and then form your own opinion. You know, nobody's going to be convinced, but they have to by somebody else. They have to come to that realization on their own. You know, one thing I wanted to mention to you, and because I know that you've mentioned Rick Strassman, you know, in some of your work, and I, you know, have interviewed him once or twice many years ago after reading the DMT molecule, and what stuck with me was the fact that I couldn't come to terms why every human being and animal species and plants have a psychoactive substance, we'll call it, you know, that's part of their physiological makeup. You know, I mean, what everything seems to have, if you believe in design, everything has a purpose. What would be the purpose of having humans and all species design with that. So, you know, it makes you wonder whether that plays a role in all of these non-physical experiences and that people talk about. I mean, what's your feeling about that?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's hard to say for sure because we don't know much about DMT. We know it's produced in the pineal gland. We know it's secreted in abundance just prior to death, and that's what has some people interested in terms of making the association. We have to be careful, of course, about what you're getting at. Is that DMT release just before death a type of biological signature maybe that reflects someone crossing over? Who knows? We're speculating, of course. Interacting maybe, simulating quantum processes within the brain, which we know exist, and have that interact with. I hate to get woo-woo, but there's theories that support the holographic concept of consciousness. Dr. Edgar Mitchell ascribes to it, many others, of course. It's controversial like all other theories, but here again, is the brain an interface between you, your consciousness, yourself, your I, your identity, whatever you want to call it, information exchange, which provides that communication, that resonant bond, shall we call it? Yeah. Between you and the cosmos, whatever that is, we can't even imagine that non-3D environment, so to speak, that people describe when they have NDEs and other kinds of out-of-body lucid dreams, etc. Feelings. They know it's the truth. It substantiates what they've realized in their body for all these years, but the brain impedes us in many ways. We need it because it's 3D, evolved here, and we got to live 9 to 5 and beyond. So we're hostage to it. It's fallible, but it's necessary for all it does. But there's consciousness too between the brain and the body. There's information exchange. And I look at consciousness, and you mentioned that earlier, you know, we're getting at what is it? You know, my best guess is that it's information exchange. And that's not a unique idea, but it occurs at every level, at a cellular level. They exchange information between cells, between organs, between the brain and organs. You know the story, of course. We can go on and on, but it doesn't end there, of course. We get into ESP experiments by Dean Radin, who we're going to be interviewing in our film, who validates ESP. That is real, without question in my mind. You have to dig into the literature, but it's very valid. And here again, he's proving that there's information exchange between humans. It's subtle, sometimes not, but yeah. it and between humans and physical systems, as in the consciousness project at Princeton University.
Yeah.
Forget the full name.
Global
consciousness body. Yeah. Exactly. So we see that information exchanges and beyond, right. And beyond. You know, so there's something there. Should it be part of Einstein's theory of relativity as another force? Maybe that's not for me to answer, but maybe that's part of the paradigm shift that when we get there, you know, in the next generation or three. So we have to be patient. We may or may not be around to be participants. I like to think we were in the past, truth seekers. Maybe our names are in the Bible, in folklore, making a reference to it. Maybe there were podcasters back then, you know, interviewing people, you know, doing something similar in some way, whatever that means. You weren't a cowboy. I know that. You weren't a cowboy in the 1800s, that's for sure.
Yeah, that would shock me if I found out that I was. So I mean, you pretty much subscribe to like the brain as a filter model, you know, that it helps to limit the endless amounts of information that we're bombarded with, and so we can navigate our physical lives.
Well, yeah, the brain does Filter all external information, certainly, in very narrow bands of energy that only our sensory systems are capable of receiving, allowing us to interpret. Yeah, our brain can only understand a very narrow range of what truly exists. We all understand that.
Yeah,
you know, dogs hear sounds we can't hear. So we understand, that's a given. But we have to understand too that that says a lot. It right there. What does that mean? That means we chew on a piece of the pie. We don't experience true reality. And the point is, maybe we shouldn't, because some psychologists say that that filter, if too wide, allows too much external stimulation that can cause mental problems. And yeah, some like schizophrenia, psychosis, it's just too much bombardment, et cetera, theory. And there's good evidence for that in some cases. Many, everybody's unique, but the point is this too: when people do psychoactive agents like DMT, the active component ayahuasca, of course, and I'm not advocating it, but you have to be very careful in controlled conditions with experienced people. If you should try it, do it at a retreat, etc. It widens that filter. Maybe it increases release of DMT. You see, that's being considered too, because
absolutely.
It has similarities with the NDEs, and that's part of the paper I wrote in the Journal of Scientific Exploration just recently, called "Spiritually Transformative Experiences." That gets at that a little bit. It's not scientifically oriented, but you can't help but not bring in some studies that look at these things and some theories and models as to why people are having these kinds of experiences. And DMT indeed is something that needs to be explored, you know, because what is that interface? You know, you could you talk about brain research, and you think about that orchestrated reduction model of Stuart Hammerhoff and Roger Penrose, anesthesiologists and leading physiologists, physicists, respectively, and they try to provide an explanation of a biological mechanism in the microtubules of the brain cells, the walls of the cells. So it's like the ladder, the structure itself, the cytoskeleton of the cell. They think that that is a key part of a gate. And they go on to explain beyond my head to fully understand how each and every conscious moment, of which there are about a million a day, according to them, it's measurable. And it's related to how the behavior of the microtubules operate. Is that the gate, you know, that opens up, allowing our that consciousness to escape, as they claim? You see, when you listen to Stuart Hammerhoff and Penrose talk about the research, they discuss that as the reason behind, and they're not alone. I know other physicists like Claude Swanson and among others who ascribe to this. They think that that gate allows for quantum processes, biophotonic emissions, microvoltage energy, of protons, photonic energy to literally be emitted from the body, and to interact, allowing for ESP, allowing for non-locality, remote viewing. You know, we interviewed Joe McMonagle, the remote viewer, the psychic spy. He told me stories that knocked me out. It's remarkable.
Absolutely.
With tremendous accuracy, you know, tremendous, from his office in the Pentagon. So what is that all about? That's proving something, not the science to accept. Maybe they open their eyes a little bit, and some with open minds to begin with, you know, take notice of it, but do nothing with it. And there's no very limited research. We go into the Rhine Center to interview after we go to the Institute of Association for Needed Studies are having a conference. You mentioned Bruce Grayson. We'll be interviewing Bruce Grayson in our documentary, Chef Mishlove, who won the Bob Bigelow contest.
Right.
Life
right.
After Death Essays, remarkable essay. We were interviewing him, and he agreed to even narrate the film, which would be great unless he's charging us an arm and a leg, you know. but you can't. I've been on his show a few times, and he asks the most beautiful questions. You know, I was just thrilled and honored, really, in talking about my book, Unseen Forces, The Integration of Science, Reality, and You. And he's so gracious. And you know what? I'm getting off the topic, and excuse me, please, I'm a little punchy.
There's a few things that you mentioned. I mean,
sure.
First, I can't tell you how many times that Claude Swanson and I were drinking single malt scotch, and he tried to explain torsion to
me.
We were you know, close for, you know, for a while. Unfortunately, he's passed on to the spirit world now. But I mean, listen, so many of the things that we talk about, it they seem to occur when our chatter brain is at rest, you know. I mean, when near death experiences, when the brain is compromised, or you know, these dream visitations that people have at different stages of, you know, of sleep. And I was once working with a scientist, and he was trying to convince me to meditate, which I have a hard time with. And I told him the best way that I the success that I have in meditating is when I kind of convince myself that I had a lobotomy, and so I can take my brain out of the equation, that information flow, you know, which you're doing quite a bit. You know, I'll tell you another story, which you might appreciate. So I went to college in the late 60s, and, well, you know, I'm in the late 60s, early 70s was the age of, you know, peace, love, and and drugs. The college, which also was part of the State University of New York system, we spent all our money on concerts. And for the one and only time in my life that I did a psychoactive substance, you know, which was mescaline, I'm not the type to do such things because I'm uncomfortable when I lose control. So we were going to a concert. We were partying all day. Somebody gave me mescaline, and it turns out I took like four times the dose that I was supposed to take. And I, for the entire day, you know, I'm just wandering around, you know, campus, and I found myself on the athletic fields after Jefferson Airplane had been there. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I find myself standing in this field with bloody feet because my I don't know what happened to my shoes. And I'm standing there and I'm watching. There was a sea of trash, you know, wherever it seemed like for miles in every direction, or just, you know what it's like after a rock concert, you know, just trash. And off in the distance, I see a man in white robes, long hair and a long flowing beard. And I remember just staring at him, and he had a stick and a bag. And one by one, he was picking up pieces of trash and putting in the bag. And I said, I remember saying to myself, like, holy shit, this is Jesus Christ. You know, so here I am, like this Jewish kid from Brooklyn, non-religious in every respect. And to this day, I can't tell you that I didn't see Jesus Christ, you know. So was that a hallucination caused by the psychoactive substance? Or was that a portal to another dimension, you know? But people have these kind of experiences, and they don't question it, but I do. So.
Well, you bring me back to the early 70s, of course. I grew up in that era, and I remember going to Central Park once. I forget the group, New Riders of the Purple Sage were playing.
Yeah.
And this just Jewish kid from the Bronx, the D train to Brooklyn and Coney Island, right?
Yeah.
And great place, great memories, except for the terrible sunburn and 1 hour ride back on a hot, humid D train back to the Bronx. I drank from a bottle that was being passed around, tasted like crap. I could even recall the taste, but I drank too much of it. I knew what was in it. It's not going to be a Pepsi. It was you're in a place where you cannot help but not drink from the bottle,
right.
Especially when you're in that mood and have that state of mind. So
yeah.
I did. Oh yeah, I was tripping, sure, hot and heavy. Wish I had mescaline. It's a lot cleaner and without as much acid, but it comes with too much acid, you have that feeling. It's good and bad. That filter opens. You're bombarded with stimuli, all stimuli, dramatized everything emotionally, not just physiologically in terms of sound and vision and such. We used to go to a museum sometimes, once or twice on acid, just to experience the museum of natural history, seeing the dinosaur bones. I've seen it 20 times, but when I did it tripping on acid, you have this different perspective, alteration of consciousness, let's call it. But associated with that is a self-transcendence. And there's an inability to differentiate between oneself and external reality. Sometimes that's called dissociation. And sometimes that's scary. And sometimes people will freak out when they are tripping. That's why I say don't do psychedelics unless somebody can talk to you about that it's normal, or what if your visual experiences, interactions with non-human entities is normal. Go with the flow, don't fight it, but to counsel you along the way. We have that alteration of time and space. You may see someone who looks like Jesus Christ, who you really think is Jesus Christ. But yet you get these kinds of metaphysical sensations. Sense of interconnectedness is something that is powerful. Okay. You feel it with the universe, with the environment. People become more ecologically sensitive after these spiritually transformed experiences. I find that this is significant.
Yeah.
But they become more loving, more empathetic, sympathetic. We know the story, less materialistic. We need to survive. We're going to be flawed in numerous ways. But the point is, we're going to be better than we were in some respects. Sometimes dramatically, sometimes not so, especially when sometimes these experiences are negative. And not everybody who has an NDE, no, I don't mean to paint a beautiful picture here. Bruce Grayson, who I may have mentioned earlier, we're going to be interviewing at this conference. He, I think, did research on negative NDEs and said that about 10 to 20% are negative, sometimes hellish. And we've heard stories, Bob. You know stories about that. Everything you expect hell to be is what they experience.
Yeah, and sometimes those negative NDEs can be attributed to a person's religious beliefs or fear that was instilled with them, through their upbringing and social environment and so forth. But you're right. I mean, not everybody sees a tunnel and moves into the glorious light, but the vast majority of experiencers do. So that's what's important.
Yeah. And they certainly do. And maybe that's what death is all about. It's a positive thing. It's a natural thing. And because we have a survival instinct in so many different ways, and sometimes that works against us when our body's decaying terribly. Because we fight to keep it alive because of that survival instinct. You know what? And when we shouldn't, and to make that decision to stop the fight is what is gut-wrenching, and that what so many of us have to face. I even hate to bring it up, but that's reality, and that's part of the pain that millions experience. But maybe that part of the survival mechanism allows for death to be a very positive thing. It's a naturally positive thing. And we see, the brain goes into this default mode network, that DMN. You've heard about that, Bob.
Yeah.
It's associated with a self-referential of referential mental activity during the resting state, and it may represent what that the so-called mediator for many of these trigger events for that feeling of transcendence or that unitive experience. Getting back to what Madison and Stace were talking about, the peak experience, and that I can't tell the difference between myself and the outer world, but I feel beautiful. Bliss, love, etc. All of that we hear, not negative, correct. So that could be part of survival again, and related to how the brain operates when it's shutting down, and associated with DMP release. It's like there is a built-in mechanism, like it is to do anything that we do as a normal function of life. In an autonomic way, not with willful intention. Just go with the flow. Don't fight it. You know, I want to take this experimental drug. It may expand my life 2 more months. In what? Pain and agony?
Right.
You know, fight, you know the story. And laws are terrible in that regard in terms of how we deal with the end of life. I don't even want to go there. You know, I was thinking, Bob, and I was working on for months, a book about aging and dying, just aging in general. Why? Because I'm turning 70 in July. I'm heck curious, right? Yeah. And it was so depressing writing about it that I stopped. Because you can't help but not read about personal comments, especially in these qualitative studies that get into statements made by those in their 80s and 90s about what life is like when they're in institutions or when they're home, mostly alone, no friends, you know, all of that. And then they paint a picture, their conclusion, not just by one, but many. I forget the psychologists or sociologists who've done some of the longitudinal demographic, thematic, semantic studies in these populations. Grim. It's grim.
Yeah. Well,
there are exceptions. There are outliers in both directions. Yeah. I don't know if that's an over-exaggeration, but physiologically, mentally, you know, you look at the incidence of chronic disorders and pain that occur, you know, that alone, let alone other things in life.
I have no, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. I have no fear of dying, which is unusual because I spent the first half of my life in terrible fear of, you know, expiring into nothingness. I couldn't conceive of it. And now, you know, as I get older, I wouldn't say that I welcome it, but it certainly doesn't bother me anymore because I do believe that, you know, I'm going to be moving to a different place. But the dying process, you know, I mean, some people are lucky and they pass in their sleep and that's a blessing. And, but others, especially after watching, you know, my wife, Fran, you know, suffer, which I thought, you know, needlessly, you know, at the end, I mean, that's what people really fear. It's not moving on to the next dimension. It's the pain and suffering that goes along with the dying process. You know, back in the day when Dr. Kevorkian became famous, I had a negative view of him, you know, and I thought that he was doing a terrible thing. And I think of him as a hero. So I think that we need to be more compassionate when it comes to the end of life. But when you found it depressing writing about these things, it's really because of what I'm talking about, I think, right? I mean, that the pain and the suffering that goes along with the dying process. But do you fear passing over?
I do less so. If I am suffering and I see no hope, I purposely save the Oxycontin that I was prescribed for my many, you know, surgeries for shoulder replacement and spinal surgeries, you know, for arthritic conditions, just in case I need it. And I say that now, but when the time comes, who knows if you pulled the trigger? But you say it as a, I don't know if that's the survival mechanism instinctually within our brains talking, or is that me? And you struggle with that when the time comes to make that kind of, I hate to talk about it because this is depressing.
I know.
But it's life. And your audience is, you know, I think your general audience is interested in this topic. So I appreciate us going in this direction.
You know, the best thing that I heard, just to flip gears, what I heard about that subject, I heard a guy say, listen, when, if the time comes, you know, when I'm hooked up, you know, to all these, you know, machines, he says to his family, I want you to unplug me. He says, and then wait 30 seconds and plug it back in and see if that works. You know, it's a little different perspective, but I just want to get back to, because you mentioned remote viewing, and yeah, I'm interested in all these things that show that, you know, the mind and consciousness can work independently of the physical brain. And I, you know, after reading, you know, tons of books about remote viewing going back, you know, 70, 80 years, you know, I was able, this was back in 2005, to conduct my own experiment. And I just told everybody that was participating that every evening in a 15-minute window between 9 p.m. and 9:15 p.m., I was going to draw a picture. That's all I said. And then I asked everybody at the end that wanted to participate at the end of the week to physically mail me all of their drawings, and just to see if there was any, you know, match to what I drew. We got a lot of responses in, and I was looking at them, and I was pretty disappointed because some things I could stretch, but there was nothing that was really, you know, valid and significant. And the very last envelope that I opened up was from a woman in Bend, Oregon, and she drew three of my drawings exact, with all the same detail, even to the point where on the last day, I decided instead of doing a drawing, I was going to draw a geometric shape, and I drew a dot with concentric circles around it. And she nailed that exactly. And so that made me, I said, wait a second, I control this, you know. So here I am, Bob, I was in New York with Bob's brain, you know, in his skull in New York. And here's this woman with her brain in her skull 3,000 miles away. And yet we were able to communicate, and, you know, because statistically, how could she guess out of a million possibilities, three drawings exactly? Yeah. And that was profoundly interesting to me, you know, because, you know, of course, if you could show that our consciousness extends beyond the body, then a belief in life after death, you know, is not so... it becomes logical, you know, if not probable.
You know, that's almost like the trigger that we were talking about.
It
opened up a window that was profound. It was a profound instance of reality for you.
Exactly.
It would be for me, Bob. It really would. Yeah. And this is the kind of stuff that's been proven in Outliers. And Gary Nolan, by the way, I actually was interviewed with him as a co-guest on a podcast last night. We, you know, he says that people who have this ability, ESP, this information exchange, just somehow tapping whatever, you know, call it whatever you want, either your brain or cosmic consciousness, where you also send information with your brain, maybe if you want to speculate, long shot, of course. You know, he would contend that the chordate putamen in the brain shows certain types of differences. And he talks about that in various papers, nothing proven, but he tries to get at that physiologic rationale. Why are some people capable of doing this? Is there a biological signature for it, marker for it? And does that represent consciousness? Again, I spoke with Joe McMonagle, and the stories he was telling me, well, let's put it this way. When I said goodbye to him, he said, and Bob, by the way, the stories I was telling you, if shared with anyone, you know, could get my wife and myself killed. And kind of smirked a little bit, but it's highly sensitive stuff.
Yeah, of CIA, course. Stargate, yeah.
Oh, he worked for them all, about where the ships are, and made the Secretary of Defense look very bad, because he was spending hundreds of millions to try to find the same things Joe McMonica was trying to find, which he did successfully, proven, validated, in his office in a 9-to-5 job, making far less than a few hundred million. So he made fun of, I forget his name at the time, of Secretary of Defense. It doesn't matter. But Dean Radin, Moosebridge, and others, they recently published studies, meta-analyses of over 300 studies on ESP, using thousands of subjects. I think it was over 5,000 subjects collectively, and supporting the validity of ESP, or again, non-local communication. What does that mean? That alone. And you tie that piece of the chessboard into the other things we're talking about, of a wide range of topics that we're covering in this short hour. We can go on and on, of course. But what does all that mean? It's obviously means something, and it has to some extent, but very limitedly, been validated in my mind scientifically, although again not accepted by mainstream science, that ESP is valid.
And that's an anomaly. So the scientific community ignores the evidence, even in these meta-analyses that you're talking about. Sometimes the odds against chance are in the billions to one, and yet they dismiss it. What I find interesting is the, when I can't tell you exactly what survey it was, but I remember a survey that was done for the scientific community, and the scientists were asked if they if they believe in God, and surprisingly, I think that the number was around 50% that said they believed in a higher power. So they, half of them believe in a higher power that they can't perceive with their senses, and they can't replicate in a laboratory, but yet they ignore evidence, with odds against chance of a billion to one. It makes no sense, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. And if they take DMT and they participate in a study on DMT at Johns Hopkins University, they find that from a large population of atheists who declared that to be the case prior to taking DMT, about 40% of them became believers in a supreme being after taking it. And for something to exert such a pronounced effect on one's philosophical beliefs, and that wasn't just that, there were a lot more flips or changes in personality across a wide dynamic of behavioral perspectives that impact the family that we know too. It has to be quite dramatic. And that's why we need a better term than spiritual transformative experience. It's a game changer, and unfortunately poorly recognized again in the medical psychiatric community in terms of proper management. And that, I think, is much of the bottom line, because whatever it is that they experience, I'll tell you the truth, whatever it is that they experience, we're talking about well-balanced people. 80 million people in a Gallup poll back in 2003 claimed to have had a spiritual transformative experience. We have to define it better, no doubt about it. We lack defining these things with great precision. But nevertheless, more research is being done. Throw in Kundalini awakenings in that too, by the way.
Yeah, and I know you had a Kundalini. Unfortunately, we don't have any time. You'll have to come back, because I could talk to you for hours. But I mean, you're a scientist who's had a personal experience like that. But
I've had a shared death experience too. I really did want to mention that.
We're going to have to talk about that.
We'll talk about it later.
I think our time is up. Listen, we've been talking with Dr. Bob Davis. If you're not familiar with his work, go to bobdavisspeaks.com. His books are, I would highly recommend all three of them, Unseen Forces, The Integration of Science, Reality, and You, Life After Death, An Analysis of the Evidence, and the UFO Phenomenon, which we didn't even get to talk about today, you know, Should I Believe? Also, you know, the easiest thing, if you go to his website, you'll see a trailer on this film that's being produced now called The Consciousness Connection, and you could be part of that. You can contribute to it, and it should have a profound effect on educating people, raising their awareness to the things that we're talking about. Bob, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Please come back again, and I'm so happy to get to talk to you for this hour.
Well, it's a pleasure, Bob, and thank you most of all for everything you do and your contributions to helping to raise awareness. It's really a pleasure to be sharing this with you. Thanks again.
And thank you. And good night, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Good night.